Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
As summer draws to a close, so does the formal Berkshire theater season, except in recent years, it's become the practice for the major theaters to stage a fall production. From September 13th to October 13th, Shakespeare and Company in Lenox will be presenting Time Stand Still, about a photojournalist facing life after being injured by a roadside bomb in Iraq. The play was nominated for a Tony Award as Best Play in 2010. My guest today is the director of Time Stand Still for the Shakespeare and Company, Nicole Ricciardi. Time Stand Still marks Nicole's seventh season with Shakespeare and Company. In past season, Nicole has directed works as diverse as the contemporary comedy drama 4,000 Miles and August Strindberg's The Creditors, which was one of the highlights of the 2018 Berkshire summer season. Welcome to Off Script, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for having me. I should say that we're going to be recording this now in the green room on the campus in Lenox. And so I appreciate you having Off Script here. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview because you're in the middle of rehearsal.
We are indeed.
So you've already put in an eight-hour day. And you could
Five hours.
there are union rules that help you out.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, so, indeed.
And before we talk about Time Stand Still, congratulations on The Creditors.
Thank you.
That was really...
Yeah. I was really happy that it was received as strongly as it was.
Yeah.
Because that's a risk.
Oh, it's hard. You know, I went to your website and I went back to Shakespeare and Company's website to prepare the interview for today. And I was looking at the summary quotations from some of the local reviewers and I happened to cross mine and I've seen... like so much stuff since last summer that I had forgotten how great that production was.
Yeah,
really,
I'm very
really
proud
good.
Of it.
Really good.
Yeah.
So, Time Stands Still.
Yes.
I gave a very brief description of it, but why don't you elaborate on that if you could for
sure.
us briefly,
yeah.
Maybe with a point of view about what the characters are and
sure.
You know, yep. what it's about for people who don't remember the play when it was on Broadway.
Great, absolutely.
2008.
Yeah. Yep, so the play is about a photojournalist, famed photojournalist named Sarah, who is injured in Iraq and sent back to New York City. And her partner, James, who is a journalist, a reporter, war reporter, who has come back a few weeks before she was injured, and we find out why in the play. I won't ruin it. And now... it's about their reentry, really, into, you know, normal civilian life back at home and how they adjust to that. The other two characters that we meet are Sarah's photo editor, Richard, who we know works for a big magazine, probably Vanity Fair, and his brand new, again, I don't want to give away too much, his brand new girlfriend, I will say, Mandy.
Mandy,
right.
The name might give you a clue
right.
about what kind of a person.
Yeah, she's a bit of a surprise,
yes, she
I will
is.
Say.
Yes, she is. So you had directed a production of this
yes.
3 years ago
yes.
at a Northampton for the New yeah. Century Theater. What's it like taking something you think you know and coming back to it 3 years later?
Yeah, it just proves that I didn't know anything.
You didn't know anything.
<the first time. laughs> Yeah, there are lines where I'm hearing for the first time, and I think, oh my God, what happened last time? The other point about it is, you know, in 3 years, how. I don't know how much more wisdom I have as a person. I mean, I'm coming back to the play as a different person. So my connection to the play is quite different than it was even 3 years ago. Meaning the thing that strikes me this time, the phrase that's really coming up for me a lot is there are different kinds of happy. I don't know if it was in the room 3 years ago, but I certainly couldn't articulate it the way I can now. You know, that, yeah, I mean, again.
Well, what was your overriding theme or mantra or moniker for what you did 3 years ago?
I couldn't tell you.
That's all right.
I couldn't tell you. Well, a clear story, I think.
Well, it does
know?
Bring up, you know, this notion. I think it was Mike Nichols who said, you know, a play's about something, but it's really about something else.
Absolutely.
So we've got a photojournalist. She comes back. She's trying to recover from wounds suffered on the job in Iraq.
And trying to get back to Iraq as soon as she can.
And she wants to go back, but she's got a boyfriend, and then she's got an editor, and then the editor's got another friend. So what's the play really about? Without giving the plot away, in terms of, like, you know, what is David? We should mention David Margolis.
Yes, absolutely.
Fabulous playwright. Who's done a lot of great stuff. So what is you as the director, what do you think this playwright is really talking about in this play?
Many things. And, but again, I mean, she's home trying
Sarah.
To, Sarah is trying, is home trying to assimilate to other people's expectations of what she should be doing and what she should want. Right, so she's a woman of a certain age. We know that she's close to the end of, you know, fertility years, right? So if she's going to have a baby, she's got to have it now. And so there's this expectation I think she puts on herself, but certainly the world is putting on her, which is, you know, to be happy as a woman of that age, you need to get married and you need to have a child. Even though her calling and her pull is for something much larger. So she wrestles with that through most of the play. You know, she has this great line where she says, if I say and do all the right things, maybe I'll feel it.
Right.
So this idea that, you know, I'm injured, I brought, I'm, I, you know, the circumstance brought me home, but now that I'm here, I'm, and everybody wants me to stay, they're worried about me, they think my job is too dangerous. Maybe it is. Maybe I will try to adapt to what other people want from me and what people are telling me that I probably in some way want. And that's sort of the struggle. It's a really interesting, you know, I was saying this the other day. I don't think I've seen a story about a photojournalist in quite this way before. The ones I've seen and the ones I've watched to prepare are, you know, these documentaries about Marie Colvin or, you know, and things like that. So they're more in a documentary style. But we really don't see in the re-entry of people who are on the fighting lines but aren't the ones fighting.
Right. In case you're just joining us, my guest is Nicole Ricciardi, and the program is Off Script, and we're talking about Nicole's directing Time Stands Still, which is going to be the fall production for Shakespeare and Company up in Lenox from September 13th to October 13th. You talked about preparation in readings and looking at some of the documentaries about war correspondents and coming back. Did you read Anne Garrel's book?
No.
No, okay. Because the Anne Garrel was an NPR reporter. And she
Of course, in
Norfolk. And you know, if you listen to Sarah, rather to Anne, talk about her work, she describes herself as a war junkie.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Yes.
And I wonder if, in your research, if you see Sarah that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's discussed almost in those words.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That there's an adrenaline rush that she gets from it, that there, you know, it feeds her in a way that normal civilian life just doesn't do.
Okay, yeah. So she's got her clock ticking, but she really wants to get back and do her job.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think there's a, how do I say this? There's a size discrepancy for her, meaning a family is a small contribution to the world, and the work she's been doing, that she's already had been doing, has had a great impact on the world. And she says, she speaks of that often, you know what I mean, that the work makes a bigger contribution than having a family would in her eyes, you know, and how can she give up the big contribution to making the big impact on the world when she's already gotten a taste of what that can do, you know? Her world becomes too small.
So the play was written in 2000 sometime.
Nine.
In 2009, yeah, first played at Geffen out in, Los Angeles, then came to New York, and it was nominated for the Tony with Laura Linney as Sarah.
And Brian Darcy James.
Alicia Silverstone.
Alicia Silverstone.
And she started doing it in
Geffen.
And then Eric Borghesian, as the...
And then Christina Ricci took over the role.
For the Broadway. Did you see that production?
I did, yes.
It was pretty pretty remarkable.
Absolutely.
So how much time are you spending on makeup on this one?
A good amount, yes, indeed.
All right.
It's an interesting because in this space, you know, the play was written for a proscenium space. It was always performed in proscenium. My last production was proscenium, meaning there's a greater distance between the actor and the audience. And in the Bernstein, it's been fabulous to hear and feel this play in there because it's incredibly intimate. You know, the audience is very close to a rather powerful piece.
So let me ask a dumb question. Mm-hmm. Then does that make doing the makeup
more of a
problem?
Absolutely.
Because you don't have that distance.
Mm-hmm. So it's got to be even more realistic, a little more subtle.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that it's not, you know, just people are just staring at her face the whole time. It is, you know, her first entrance onto the stage is quite powerful, you know, when we see what's happened to her.
When did you start rehearsal on this?
2.5 weeks ago.
Oh, and you've got another 5 days.
Well, we'll go into tech next week.
That's
pretty
good.
And then we have a week from tonight will be our first preview with an audience.
Casting.
Mm-hmm.
You pull from Shakespeare and Co.
because it's
a repertory company,
absolutely,
right? What kind of things were you looking for in Sarah? I mean, you know Sarah pretty well. You've directed another Sarah.
Absolutely.
You probably have part of Sarah in you.
Probably.
At this
indeed,
point.
Yeah.
So what are you looking for in your Sarah?
Well, everything that Tam brings, you know, Tamara.
Tamara Hickey.
Yes, absolutely.
Sarah, right?
I mean, the nice thing about the four people I have in this show is that I've seen a lot of their work here for years, and it was just my turn. I finally got them. So there's a passion and a really sharp intelligence that Tam brings to this role. So I already knew, you know what I mean?
Good.
DJ is,
that's David Joseph.
David Joseph, right?
Yeah.
You know, again, very sharp, sweet, kind, and an infectious enthusiasm, which is such an important part for this role.
And that character has to have... his empathy's got to go a long way.
A long way. He has quite a big journey in this play.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite a big arc there.
Yeah. And what about your little Mandy?
Oh, man.
Shouldn't say little Mandy.
Yes. Okay. Again, a fierce intelligence. I mean, what Caroline brings to this role.
This is Caroline Calkins.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, I've gotten to watch her do a lot of work in the past few years. And Mandy, again, without giving away too much, I think is someone who could easily be written off if there isn't a fierce intelligence under that and a real sense of honor and standards and morality. I mean, she really is the one who drives all the change in the play.
Right.
And she has to come from a real sense of truth.
Absolutely. She's the foreigner.
Absolutely.
Right. But, and she has an entirely different kind of intelligence.
Absolutely.
I mean, almost a different vocabulary
about
the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's not silly, and it's
it's
very grounded. She knows what she's talking about, and she's, you know, the beautiful thing about this script is that it's so balanced. There are times where you go, she's right. And then the next minute, the other character says something, and you're torn between two very opposing and equal arguments the whole time.
So why did you come back to the play now? You did it 3 years ago.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been it's a very different experience, even the way the world has changed in the past 3 years. The biggest change for me is that 3 years ago, we set it in the present, meaning we moved it to 2016.
Okay, yep.
And it wasn't without problems, meaning the references in the plays and sort of the tone of the play was sort of bumping up against 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are 3 years later. I went back to the play, and there was almost no way it would work in 2019. It's not a post-Me Too Trump era world.
Right.
So what I ended up doing is I went back to 2009. I looked back and I said, when was the first production? I went back, did some research about 2009, and the play burst to life. So we are setting it in the year.
Fascinating.
It was written.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, all of us relaxed, and the play, again, bloomed in a way I couldn't have predicted.
Talking about how plays let us see the world, okay, in a different way.
Absolutely.
When they really work, and we see the world in a play through the main character's eyes. Talk about what it's like to deal with a character named Sarah who sees the world through a camera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're a director. Yeah. You're not a movie director.
Right. Yes.
So you probably see the world more through the script and how it's going to be staged.
Absolutely.
But so how does that affect your thinking in dealing with a main character who sees the world through a camera?
Right. Well, I mean, it lends to the way she makes decisions throughout her life, you know. She was able to, she speaks of this pretty beautifully in the play. She says, I'm able to freeze time. I'm able to take horrific events and put a literally a lens between me and the event.
Hence the title.
Yes, hence the title.
Still,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So her ability to gain control over horrific circumstances is what drives her into thinking that she can find a similar control over everything in her life. And what she can't do is you can't do that to people you love. You can't freeze them in time and move them about the way she can her photographs. You know, that sort of sense of control that she has in her work, she can't bring mm-hmm. into the rest of her life, which is where the conflict really starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's fascinating, that idea that, you know, she's mastered the ability to freeze time
mm-hmm.
and control things around her. The worst possible things she, you know, a person could witness, she has witnessed and dealt with in a way by making it very small and removing herself right through a camera lens.
Mm-hmm.
And here she is now in her life not able to do that. So really just clocking all the times and all the ways throughout the play where she's trying to use her work skills in her life
mm-hmm.
and how those, it doesn't work.
Remind me what the boyfriend does.
James is a reporter.
He's a reporter.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so he sees the world through the printed page.
Absolutely. And he has to read, and he talks about it in the play, how he, in order to write about it, he actually has to revisit the events. He has to relive things in order to write about it. And he does talk about very articulately how different their processes are, right? Once the picture's taken, it's taken. She can futz with it. She can, you know, make it bigger, larger. She can change things. But it's done, and it's sent. And the interpretation of what's in a photo is really not up to her. She takes the photo, and then the viewer, right, can interpret what they see and how different his process is, how much more work it takes, how much more psychological toll, and the cost of having to revisit things and write about it is so great. And really taking a toll on him.
But there must be a psychological cost to Sarah, too, because in Absolutely. Taking pictures and freezing tragedies in time, the world will always revisit
yes.
that tragedy.
Absolutely.
And she has to live with the responsibility of having brought that
yep.
to the world's attention.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I remember that in the play,
Absolutely.
Too. I think it's
Absolutely.
There.
And the big event, I mean, meaning having gotten injured, taken out of the work environment, right, and dropped back, you know, on a couch in Brooklyn. This is the first time she has stood still in years.
Right.
And I know in my own life, in those times where I'm going, I'm racing past things in my life. I can use work to avoid a lot of things.
Right.
And then when the work stops, life creeps in.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I have the time to think about it. I have the time to you know, to deal with it, to think about things, and everything comes roaring up. And that's what we see in this play.
And we talked about how Mandy mm-hmm. is coming from another world and sort of upsets the apple cart, as
Absolutely.
It were, among the...
She's the normal human. She's the normal citizen. She even calls herself, she says, I think she calls herself an ordinary person. Right.
Well, because don't you think, I mean, have you spent all time with this? I mean, people who are war junkies, whether they're photojournalists or whether they're reporters, and even... Richard is a photo editor.
Absolutely.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of like people in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
People in journalism are not mere mortals.
No,
neither
absolutely.
Are people in theater.
Right.
It's yeah. a different breed of animal.
Yeah. So she comes in and she yeah. listens and she watches and then she starts to question.
You people are screwed up.
Absolutely. Why would you do this? And she has valid points.
Yeah.
Again, especially in this production, the fierce intelligence of Caroline Calkins, it really brings that home. She, you know, holds their feet to the fire mm-hmm. and says, I don't understand why you do what you do. It doesn't make any sense to me that you would put your life on the line like this. So that there's a real defense of the work.
In case you're just joining us, I'm Dan Dwyer, and my program here is Off Script. We're talking to Nicole Ricciardi, who's the director of Time Stands Still, which is the fall production for Shakespeare and Company up in Lenox, from September 13th to October 13th. What do you look for? I mean, you commented before how Margolis' script is so well written,
mm-hmm.
as is most of his, all of his stuff. What do you, when you pick up a play to read, to decide if you haven't seen it before, well, that's first of all, that's another question.
Right.
Do you avoid seeing plays in other productions that you know you might direct so that
nope.
it doesn't inform?
I'm okay. the complete opposite. I know a lot of people, many of my colleagues
yeah.
are like that. I've never been that way.
Okay.
I've always been You know, it's usually something I've seen that there's a pull, and often it's because I'm hearing or seeing it in a different way as I'm experiencing it, and then I want to get in and I want to try it myself. Almost always.
Okay, so if it's a play that's a, if it's a new play that hasn't been produced before, what do you? How do you read a script?
Oh, out loud, always.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't. I silently reading a script. I can't do it anymore. I'll start
even
that way.
Even if you're reading a script just to see if you might want to direct this.
Absolutely.
You sit there, lie there in bed, and read out loud.
I do, and I play the parts, and I get it. Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I have to, especially with a play like a writer like this, where it's so rhythmic. The next thing I'm doing is Carol Churchill. I'll be doing that at school this fall.
And which one are you doing?
I'm doing Love and Information, which is so exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean,
is that the one with, like, 167 little episodes?
Yes, absolutely.
I saw that at the Royal Court.
Oh, wow. Oh,
when it was I think it's only about, what, 6 or 7 years old?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it came to New York. I saw it at the Royal Court, and I brought my husband, who I drag along to a lot of theater with me. And Jim, if he's listening, God bless you once again.
Yes.
And he's got Catholic taste, small c, and he's a very smart guy. But there are some things that he just can't get into, and he can't get into Carol.
Oh, absolutely.
I think she's great.
Yeah, it's a definite an acquired taste.
Yeah, yeah. So that was incredible, because some of those plays are like, I think one is like 27 seconds, and then there's another one that's like 13
absolutely.
And a half minutes or something.
And again,
like that.
Very rhythmic.
Yeah.
You know, so almost the comprehension of it, I don't understand it until I've spoken it out loud, almost certainly.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that happens a lot.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's usually something I've seen or heard, and that's what's
so when you read a script to decide whether this is something you want to do, okay, so is it the story that it sounds to me, if you're talking out loud, it seems to me you're looking for the rhythm of language as much as maybe in some cases more than you're looking for story.
Maybe. I mean, I think the story is the hook. I tend to like stories with an interesting female character or a female point of view. Even Creditors, I would argue. Do you know what I mean? She is a force to be reckoned with, so I'm always interested in that. And something that is timely, meaning there's something to be gained from it. You know, in a similar sense to Sarah, what I understand, as a middle-aged woman who has never had a child and is yet to be married, you know, my contribution is going to be this, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, I'm a storyteller, so what stories do I feel I could tell in a good way that would make an impact?
I went onto your website, you know, in preparing for this chat, and you've done a lot of your own storytelling, and you produce some of your own stuff. And one of the things that intrigued me about what I read on your website is that you did an all-male production of The Comedy of Errors, performed by California gold miners in 1852 with two actual sets of identical twins.
Absolutely.
This has nothing to do with Time Stand Still.
Right,
but tell me a little bit about this, because I'm fascinated by this.
There was a bunch of actors, all male actors of a certain age.
What's the name of your company?
It was called The Wild Court.
Okay.
Yeah, and we wanted to do a Shakespeare, and it was just happened to be all young men in this company.
In New York?
At the time, yes. Yeah. So all the ladies were busy doing something. And I thought, and they're like, well, we want to do a Shakespeare. And I said, okay. And I said, well, we could just do an all-male Shakespeare. I said, let me marinate on this. That happens a lot, where I will go, give me a week and something will happen. And often when I ask for something to happen, it's as if a light switch is turned on. Mm-hmm. I was teaching a class of professional actors. One of them was working, his day job was at a local book publishing company that was going under, unfortunately. So what he did was he brought me all of the books about Shakespeare, because it was a Shakespeare class I was teaching. And one of them was, I can't remember the title, I wish I did. And I was reading it on the subway back from class. And in it, it talked about how the gold rush was one of the most popular times in history for Shakespeare plays.
Fascinating.
I had no idea.
Why?
Because they had a sort of, they had an audience. They trapped, literally a trapped audience. So what they would do is these companies would go up through the mines and tell these stories. And the men knew the plays very, very well. Most popular, Richard III, which I thought was really interesting. And the miners usually had a copy of Shakespeare with him in the camps. They'd have a Bible and they'd have a copy of the complete works. So these men were reading the plays and would actually recite the text with the company.
Fascinating.
So they made a lot of money, and these companies that went up through, and then all of a sudden it clicked. You know, the miners, the gold rush, no women around. And so we came up with this premise. I went back into a meeting and I said, how do we make this work? And it just happened that we had a group of miners who hadn't found any gold. They found a way to make some money. There was an identical set of twins in this group, and off we went. And we had two identical twins play the two twins. And so it was a play within a play, right? So we had this group of miners who were putting on the play of The Comedy of Errors. And it was quite an experience.
Fascinating. When was this?
Let me see. This must have been 4 years ago. Yeah. And we want to do it again. We think we're going to do it again.
Good.
Because,
Yeah. In New York?
New York. Yeah. It was great.
Okay. Tell me about this other little number you did called We Eat Chekhov.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Play with music.
Uh-huh. Yes, indeed. I got my master's degree in Russia.
Uh-huh.
It was a program via Carnegie Mellon at the time, but it was from the Moscow Art Theater. So I knew the Chekhov vaudevilles very, very well. We performed them all, I believe, while I was over there.
For people who don't know, what is a Chekhov vaudeville?
It's his one-act plays that he put on. They were almost like cabarets, right, that he would put on in an evening, sort of in a salon, right? And they were very funny, kind of light, really well-written plays. And he's written quite a few, and the two that we did were The Bear, I think, is the most mm-hmm. famous, and then A Wedding was the mm-hmm. other one. And so I don't know, I can't remember where this idea came up, but I was working with a composer. We had worked on a couple of shows, and we had this idea, again, I don't know where the germ of this came from, but a group of climatologists get stranded up in the North Pole. And they get dropped at the wrong base. They get dropped at an abandoned Russian base. And the weather gets so bad that they can't leave. And one of the only things in the bunker is a copy of Chekhov. And so it gets to the point where they're eating beans out of a can. And one of them starts to, who's sort of a kind of an interested actress anyway, starts to stage these plays.
So what's your theme here? Theater is survival? Really?
Yeah,
think about it with those two plays.
I like dropping familiar text into unfamiliar mouths. That seems to be, and the transformative power of that, right? So we've got a bunch of scientists stuck in this bunker who really find themselves through the work of Anton Chekhov in the performing of work that they would never, you know, in an environment where they feel safe enough to do that. You know, so that, and that same thing with Comedy of Errors, these rough and tumble grub miners who kind of find their vulnerability, especially the men playing the women.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I'm going to look forward to the Comedy of Errors on its new production in New York sometime. But what we're looking forward to now is your direction of Time Stands Still.
Indeed.
At the Shakespeare and Company from September 13th to October 13th. I want to thank you
for
having me here, and thank you very much for taking time during your rehearsal. And break a leg.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thanks for joining us. The program again, Off Script, on Robin Hood Radio, based here in Sharon, the smallest NPR station in the nation. If you've liked what you've heard on this program and others, go to robinhoodradio.com and on the support page, express your support. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.